Eye has not seen, nor has ear heard, neither has there entered into the minds of men the things which God has prepared for those who love Him. For He who spared not His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how shall He not with Him freely give us all things? He has done exceedingly abundantly beyond all we could ever ask or think, for we have the mind of Christ. And you may open the mind of Christ this morning to Song of Solomon, chapter 2. We'll do a brief review beginning at verse 3. It is customary for us to pause for a few moments of silent prayer. This will afford you the opportunity, if necessary, to utilize the unique privilege of the royal priesthood, which is confession alone to God alone, rebound if necessary, and to make whatever mental attitude adjustments are required for concentration upon our study, which would include a concentration that would avoid any unnecessary movement that might be a distraction to others. With these things in mind, shall we pray? Heavenly Father, we are indeed grateful to You for Your matchless grace, the continuance of Your provisions to us, and today we take advantage of those involved in the theological arena. We have all of the assets necessary to pull within our soul these concepts and ideas which You provide through the phenomenal mentorship of the Holy Spirit. And it is our prayer that through His guidance, the things we do here today will contribute to our spiritual growth, and we lift our prayer to that end in Christ's name. Amen. We are, as you know, involved in a study of the book of the Song of Solomon, and we've made our way into chapter 2, and we have seen a little bit of verbal sparring between Solomon and the Shulamite woman. The thing that sustains the Shulamite under the pressure of being, let's say, recruited by Solomon, who hopes to bring her into his harem, is the ability of this woman to concentrate under pressure. Now, we see literal events taking place in the book. The book should be translated literally, for it is a testimony to the right man, right woman relationship. The events that we are noting are historical. They are those that were witnessed and participated in by Solomon. And in his latter days, he chose to write about them. The Shulamite woman is left unnamed. Her moniker actually is based on her area of residence. And she has a right man that has identified her as his right woman. He has planted his banner of love in her soul, and that is a protection for her. She has great memories of him. We've noted the memory center and how it can recall things that are of great asset to us when we are under pressure. Were it not for the ability to recall doctrine, then the time spent on studying it would be useless. And so the memory is very, very important when functioning under pressure. You have to be able to remember what you know. And she remembers her right man, and that is a stabilizing factor for her. For Solomon seeks to bring her into his harem, which now exceeds 1,000 women. But he is taken by her and even has the notion that he might be his right woman. He has a very flawed ability to determine this, since he has actually damaged his soul on hundreds of occasions with his ongoing harem. But nevertheless, it's probably some sort of libido on his part. That doesn't in any way change the fact that he is making this effort and that she is caught in this situation. Now, she remembers her right man, the shepherd, and that gives her sustenance, courage, endurance to manage a conflict, a verbal conflict that goes on between her and her leader. He is the king of Israel, and she must, of course, because of his position of authority, give him some deference. But she must be very careful as she does it, at the same time seeking to protect her soul from this assault. And, of course, she has to verbalize this on some occasions, but it's couched in this beautiful poetry. And you see that she even insults Solomon in verse 3 of chapter 2. Now, he has, therefore, in chapter 2, verse 2, he's made the comment that she is like a lily among the thorns. And the thorns are the virgin standing over in the corner, and they've been insulted. And she then decides to give a retort, and she doesn't identify who the apple tree is. The apple tree is the shepherd, and the other trees in the apple orchard are the other guys, including Solomon. Well, here's how it goes as far as we've gone in chapter 2, beginning with her aria that begins in verse 3. Like an apple tree among the trees of the grove, so is my beloved among the young men. In his shade I took great delight and sat down, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. We did note that verse, by the way. They're smooching there at the end. Verse 4. He brought me to the banquet house, and his banner of love over me, or his banner over me, was love. The banquet house is a type of restaurant where wine was sold. An actual literal translation of banquet house would be wine house. And that's a restaurant where they have a pretty good wine cellar of some sort. Wine was obviously very popular. The Shulamite's family is involved in a vineyard and a winery, and a very high class as a result, selling all of this wine. Then the banner of love is interesting. We took time to note that. Standards are very important to armies. There are places around which groups can reorganize. Certain units get disheveled on a battlefield, and they can find their standard and therefore reorganize, and that is a place of safety. And we studied that. And his banner over her is unconditional love, thus identifying her as his right woman. This passage also could be interpreted as the point that he proposed to her. That's possible, but I believe that he proposed to her on a stairwell in her home. And we may or may not get to that today. And then she goes on in verse 5 by saying, "Sustain me with raisin cakes, refresh me with apples, because I am lovesick." This is a psychosomatic problem. It has to do with the emotions involved that relate to the stress placed on her by Solomon and the devotion she has to her absent shepherd. And all of this causes her to go into a low blood pressure zone, and she faints, partially faints. She doesn't fall out, but she does become weak. And she asks for the virgins to help her by sustaining her with raisin cakes, that's nutrients, and refresh me with apples. A sliced apple in the ancient world is sort of a form of smelling salts that we might use today. And this gets her back on her feet. And then she continues in verse 6, "Let his left hand be under my head and his right hand embrace me." Here is a romantic moment she conjures in her mind. This is fantasy on her part, because she would rather imagine herself having physical sex with her shepherd in the environment of marriage through imagination, rather than have it dawn on her that that's what Solomon has on his mind. So this is a defense mechanism for her, and she imagines being with her right man in marriage rather than the horror of having to submit to Solomon. And that's what goes on in verse 6. And then in verse 7, she looks over at the daughters of Jerusalem, the virgins, and adjures them, "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the hinds of the field, that you do not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases." Their job is to recruit her into Solomon's harem, and their job, therefore, is to get her to, let's say, spike her libido in favor of Solomon. And she's saying to them, "Don't try this on me, because I'm saving myself for my right man." And then in verse 8, we have this vocative, "Listen." That's a voice orientation. "Listen, my beloved, behold, he is coming, climbing on the mountains, leaping on the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young hart," which is a deer. And this is something that you see. You see the gazelles and the deer loping across the valleys and what have you. And when you see that, it's a very beautiful sight. We were coming back from Alabama, and on a couple of occasions we saw deer draped over back ends of pickups. And my wife was very disturbed about that. And I said, well, you know, that maybe that family's food for the rest of the winter. So this is okay. Unless, of course, you live in town and country. They prefer them in town and country to die impaled on fences or to starve to death. But elsewhere, they actually thin the herds and use them for food. This is a good thing. This is called dominion, by the way. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young deer. And the gazelle and young deer, as they frolic and play, are very graceful. And she believes that her shepherd is a very graceful individual. And she loves the way he looks. And we'll see that in our study. Behold, he is standing behind our wall. He is looking through the windows. He is peering through the lattice. And the lattice is, of course, a type of shutter, let's call it, that you would put over a window that doesn't have glass. Didn't have glass then. So we have voice orientation here, and we have visible orientation. And she responds to her right man's voice. And we've studied that on our last occasion here. A voice orientation is very important in the right man, right woman relationship. The husband should have a voice of authority to his right woman. She must respond to his voice. This is an indication of right man, right woman. He, of course, responds to her voice. This is a type of exchange that is very wonderful between a man and a woman. Also, the appearance. Now, the appearance has nothing to do with what is generally considered to be beauty and handsomeness. The appearance of your right person, whomever they may be, is the important thing. So the outward appearance must be attractive to the person involved. In other words, God has made a perfect person for you, and however they appear is wonderful to you. And it's therefore it can be some drop-dead gorgeous model type, you know, with all of the accoutrements, or it could be an average-looking individual. And I looked out on that part. So the point is that the looks orientation has to do with what goes on between a man and a woman who are made for each other and they've discovered each other. And so when she sees her right man, the shepherd, he may be a stud muffin for all we know. But on the other hand, you know, he may be somebody who's just been beat down by following sheep all of his life, you know, just absolutely bedraggled. But he is gorgeous to her. So these are the ideas that come out of verses 8 and 9. Listen, my beloved, behold, he is coming, climbing on the mountains and leaping on the hills. And so she sees that. That's a visual orientation. And then she thinks that he's very, very graceful and compares him to the gazelles and the deer. Behold, now look where his location is. This is where we left off. He is standing behind our wall. He is looking through the windows. He is peering through the lattice. Now, in the ancient world, in estates, which they would have, being in the wine business, you would have an outer wall, and then there would be an inner wall, and then there would be the house, and the house would be two stories. So you have a wall that he gets behind here, and then there's an inner wall, and she sees him making his way through this these obstructions. And she has a window. And the lattice apparently is fixed in such a way that he can peer through here looking for her. So this is a tryst. Now, a tryst is a meeting, a secret meeting. And so he is setting up a tryst here with her. Now, why does he have to have a secret meeting with her? Because the brothers don't like him. He's too low down on the social scale for them. He's just a shepherd boy. And they are in the wine business. And she's trying to marry down. And when they get wind that Solomon is courting her, they're really going to be excited about that, even though she would only be a member of a harem of over 1,000 women. So these guys have their eyes on the dollar rather than on right man, right woman. So he's peering for her and hopes to find her, and then they will meet privately. Because if he were to knock on the front door, he's learned, the brothers would shoo him off. Now, when married to the right man, his voice becomes a voice of authority to which the wife responds, and his is the voice of the one to whom she has committed her soul, her spirit, and her body. Recall of the visual appearance of the shepherd indicates that the Shulamite is also sight-oriented to him, and she likes what she hears when he speaks, and she likes what she sees when he appears. And at the moment, the Shulamite is present with the king of Israel. She does not like what she hears when he speaks, and she does not respond to his voice. She does not like what she sees and thus does not respond to his appearance. She is neither vocally nor visually oriented to Solomon and therefore does not respond to him, with the exception of authority orientation with regard to his status as her king. And so she has to respect his title and his office, although she has no personal response to him in any way. Now we resume our study at point 24. We're in document 189, page 1973. Verse 10 is the Shulamite's recall of her late night rendezvous with the shepherd as he comes to the back wall of the family estate and makes his way to her window. Now, this is made necessary, by the way, as I pointed out, by the fact her father is dead, and in the Jewish society, the brothers then would be the ones who would manage the sibling sister. And they have to make sure she's cared for and protected, and that, in their mind, is what they're doing. At least that is the rationale that they're using. So these secret trysts are required because the father is dead and supervision of the sister has been delegated to her two brothers who disapprove of their charge's relationship with the shepherd. He's too low down on the social scale. He can't make enough money herding sheep. They are more elite than that. They don't like him. She can do better kind of concept. Nevertheless, the things she remembers are these romantic times when he came to her window, and she could see him coming, and she heard his voice, and she responded. 26. The Shulamite now recalls and then relates the conversation she had one evening with the shepherd. The Shulamite quotes the shepherd, but nevertheless we will interpret the passage as if the shepherd were in the scene. She continues with the aria, but she is quoting the shepherd here beginning in verse 10. So we will, I have a color code going so you can keep up with who's speaking. And I think the color code here is an earthy brown. I thought that'd be good for the shepherd who worked outside. So you can see he's got his color. And he is going to appear in the script here as if he is the one speaking, but he is actually being quoted by the Shulamite. So we have Song of Solomon 2, beginning at verse 10, where the Shulamite woman sings, "My beloved responded and said to me." Now, he's shown up at the window, and they have met. We'll see where they meet in a few minutes. But they're going to meet in a secret, private place. It's a rendezvous. It is a tryst. And they seek a private place where they can have a moment, a romantic moment together, and have conversation. Now, he begins the conversation in the second half of verse 10. "Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. For behold, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers have already appeared in the land. The time has arrived for pruning the vines, and the voice of the turtle dove has been heard in our land. The fig tree has ripened its figs, and the vines in blossom have given forth their fragrance. Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along." Okay, what do you think of that? So that's a little smoother, I think, than Solomon. And he knows exactly what to say because he knows what his right woman responds to. So there's some things to be noted here. We've got 1, 2, 3.5 verses to analyze and to see what this is all about. What on earth is he talking about? Why would he say these things to her, except to be romantic, which apparently he has been. But there are other things that are involved here that we can analyze and see why he brings these things up. And then from that, we will conclude that he is proposing to her. So point one, notice how the shepherd addresses the Shulamite in verse 10. He refers to her as "my darling" and "my beautiful one." And these are terms of endearment, but they do not imply possessiveness. And we'll see that Solomon has no reticence to refer to her already the first day he's met her. He hasn't seen her before this day. And he is willing to refer to her as his wife. Now that is presumptuous, precocious, arrogant, etc. So secondly, it is important for young men to understand that they are privileged to enjoy the company of a young woman. And even when the two come to the point of right man, right woman identification, the concept of possession can be assumed, but should not be stated directly. You start calling her your wife and then treating her as such already, as if you own her, you're going to find that this is not a good thing to do. Now, it is okay, as we will note in our passage, it is all right to assume that she will become your wife, for each of you have agreed on the concept of right man, right woman. But to take possession ahead of the ceremony is something that you do not do. It may be a mental assumption or conclusion, but certainly nothing that would be stated directly. You must remember the woman has free will. Because you're marrying her does not rob her of that, her personality, her independence, her individuality. There is a system to which she is required to submit as the woman in the corporate relationship of marriage, but that in no way implies that her volition has been neutralized. And it certainly hasn't been neutralized before the I do's have been exchanged. She's still an independent party that can make the decision that, hey, I was wrong about this, and I'm going to ride off into the sunset. I'm real sorry, but I'm gone. And she has a right to do that, and I would advise those who are not married, if you get to the point of the preacher coming in the side door, ready to do the ceremony, and it dawns on you that you've got the wrong person, it is okay to say to the preacher, and that would include me, you know, I don't think I want to do this today. And in fact, I'm leaving, and I hope y'all have a fine day. And all that, all the bustle of that big dress and the thing that drags along behind, she'd just march right out the back door and get in the car and drive off into the sunset and would be better for it. And everybody else would be able to get over it eventually. Now, a movie. I like to use movies as illustrations when they are pertinent, and I think I found one. There may be others, but I recently ran across this one on my on-demand and on my widescreen HD TV. A movie that does a great job showing the development of the right man, right woman relationship is The Man from Snowy River. Don't know if any of you have seen that. I stumbled across it. It's not a new movie. I think, was back in the 80s, if I remember correctly. Well, now, this film stars Tom Berlinson as Jim Craig, the suitor of Sigrid Thornton's character Jessica Harrison, and Kirk Douglas as her father. The story is loosely based on the poem of the same name by A.B. Banjo Patterson, the late 19th and early 20th century Australian journalist and poet, who also composed Waltzing Matilda in 1917. It's the unofficial Aussie national anthem. Now, this is a family movie and was nominated in 1983 for a Golden Globe as Best Foreign Film, foreign meaning Australia. Now, the last line in the movie is the best. It is spoken by Jim Craig, that's Tom Berlinson, to Mr. Harrison, Kirk Douglas. Here's the quote. "There are a dozen good brood mares in that mob, and I'll be back for them, and for whatever else is mine." Now, the movie involves a very beautiful young lady, Sigrid Thornton, as Harrison's daughter. And Tom Berlinson is a mountain man. He's a horseman. And he, therefore, is involved in running horses and sheep and things of that nature. So he's like a rancher. And the guy down in the valley, Kirk Douglas, has got a bunch of money and a big spread and high-toned horses and that kind of thing. And he thinks that she, getting close to this mountain man, is not a good idea because he's of the lower social strata. He's just a horseman, a sheep herder, a guy who lives in the mountains. You don't want to associate with people like that. Well, it turns out they're right man, right woman. But he doesn't want her to marry him because he can't provide her with a life to which she has become accustomed down in the valley. And so he's in big opposition to their relationship. And it reminded me of this situation with the brothers, the Shulamite and the shepherd, and how Solomon probably would be right down their alley. So there is this conflict that goes on between Burleson and Douglas all the way through the movie. But finally, as the romance develops and it becomes apparent to each of them that they're right for each other, and the father is still standing in the way. He winds up pulling off a big stunt because he's a fantastic horseman, and he is able to save this wonderful horse that this Harrison guy prized so much. He's able to save it from a bunch of bungees, I think they call it, a word they have for wild horses down there. And he was able to save this horse. And so he gets them all back to Harrison's ranch, and then he says, "Now that I've saved this whole bunch, there are a bunch of good brood mares in that mob, and I'm going to come back and get them. You know, I rounded them up and they're mine. And when I do come back, I'm going to get anything else that belongs to me." And what he's talking about is Harrison's daughter. And you can come back and get her. Because they've identified each other as right man, right woman. Now, he went to improper and asked for a hand in marriage. And he came unwound that he would even have that cross his mind. So here's a piece of advice for young men who have identified their right woman and she has identified him as her right man. You go through the proper mannerly procedure to go through the thing in a very smooth and mannerly way by asking the permission of the father to take the daughter's hand in marriage. And if he says no, it had better be a real good reason. And then you can back off and give some time there. But once you're 21 years of age in our society and are able to make decisions on your own, and you're convinced that you can provide for this individual, you're convinced that you're right for each other, you have a place to get her in out of the rain, you can make sure she can eat 3 meals a day, you make sure she has the proper clothing, you can make sure that these basics are provided through your efforts alone, and you're able to do that, then you can come back and you can get whatever else is yours. This comment reveals Craig's conclusion that Jessica is his right woman, while her father doesn't think he is financially stable enough or sophisticated enough to court his daughter, let alone marry her. It turns out that he is half owner in a gold mine, and this comes to light toward the end of the movie. Harrison doesn't know this, that this young man, is as he rides off into the sunset after having given this declaration, has more money than he does. And he'll be able to take care of her just fine, thank you. Point 5. A man can identify his right woman and conclude that she is the one God has given to him. But he must never assert to her that you are my wife until this becomes a reality. So he has terms of endearment for her. My darling. My beautiful one. Those are terms of endearment. And we'll note in a moment they do have possessive pronouns in front of them. But they do not in any way imply ownership. So Solomon took this leap of faith and referred to the Shulamite on 6 occasions as my bride. And the word that is translated my bride, I think that's the New American Standard, is K-A-L-L-A-H, Kalah. And this is found in 5 consecutive verses. Song of Solomon 4, verses 8 through 12, and then chapter 5, verse 1. So we can move forward in the Song of Solomon as this conversation continues onward. And we see in chapters 4 and 5 where Solomon refers to her as Kalah. And this word is best translated wife or spouse. Not my bride, my wife or my spouse. Take your pick. Therefore, he is asserting possession. He never saw her before this day. Some dating relationship. That was some, what do you call that? Engagement. We have an engagement that's lasted about 15 minutes and now he's calling her his wife. 7. Solomon is arrogant. He has been so successful in luring women into his harem that it never crosses his mind that any woman would turn down his proposal for marriage. He considers himself to be very handsome, and he probably was. He's richer than Croesus, and he's got all of the assets you can imagine, including a palace. So why would ladies turn him down? The shepherd can legitimately claim her as his bride, since they have both come to the status of soul rapport and identified each other as the right person. This is where he planted the banner in her soul of love. This is where he claimed possession in the sense of identification of her being his right woman. And he planted that banner of unconditional love. I will protect you. I will love you. I will keep you. I will provide for you, etc. And that was the moment of their identification. And we're in a passage now that we're going to see is where he actually proposes marriage to her. He has come to her estate. He sneaks in the back door, comes through an opening of some sort, whether he crawled in a window or went through a door, I don't know. But they managed to meet in a stairwell where he proposes to her. And in essence, what he's saying is, come away with me. Let's get out of here. Let's get away from the brothers. Let's get away from the foxes. Let's get away from the wine vines. Let's get away from the wine center. Let's get away from everybody here. Let's go away. Doesn't work out for them, but there's your proposal. He doesn't verbalize this to her, the concept that his bride is in his arms. He doesn't verbalize this to her, thus respecting not only her volition, but the principle that he doesn't yet have the right to refer to her in this way. He doesn't have the right to do that. He hasn't gone through the proper procedure. And the proper procedure is a period of time after which compatibility has been recognized and soul rapport is developing. There is an engagement period. It's been interrupted by the family. And therefore, as a result of this miscooperation from the brothers and apparently the approval of the mother, they haven't had the opportunity to have a normal engagement period. But they have had plenty of time to discern that they are right for each other. And they want to be with each other. They desire to be with each other. They have passions for each other. But they are denied to be with each other. And so he therefore makes the proposal, why don't we just go away? Therefore, the context of this tryst occurred some time ago at the Shunem estate before she was banished to the vineyards. Now, when the book opens, we find her chasing foxes in the vineyards. Foxes in the vineyards, and Solomon shows up. So Solomon comes up and sees her chasing the foxes around the vineyard, and then he sends out the virgins, and the virgins are to recruit her into the harem. And then she winds up at Solomon's tent. And then she has to use various methods by which she is going to defend herself against his advances. And here we see her, on one occasion, use her imagination to try and fend him off. And she thinks back, or rather imagines, on this occasion, she imagines that she is with the shepherd in a marital relationship. And then later on, she begins to quote the shepherd. And this is the defense mechanism. She goes back in time to something that occurred up here before she was sent to the vineyards to chase off foxes. And that's the passage we're in. So time-wise, this is before the book starts. And she is thinking back on this conversation in the stairwell. Now, point 10. The attitude that a young man should have once he identifies his right woman should be grace orientation. I'm telling you the truth that once you find your right woman, you're flabbergasted and speechless that this kind of thing could happen. And you're absolutely astonished. And you ought to be grateful for it. Just absolutely grateful to the good God in heaven that would prepare another person specifically for you. That is phenomenal. And that's the attitude young men ought to have. When they find their right person, and there is that clicking, that fusion, that incorporation of souls, and you find your right person, and you know that person is for you forever, then that ought to be grace orientation. And that should be the case here, and is. His response should not only include unconditional love for the woman, but reciprocal love to God for so great a gift, an absolute gift of another human being, specifically designed for you. Here the shepherd pursues his romance with the Shulamite, but he is forced to do so under the cover of darkness. We've explained why. He entreats her to come to him so they can enjoy each other's company. He does not identify her as his right woman by referring to her as my love. He does this and compliments her by calling her my beautiful one. These are legitimate terms of endearment. Although they have possessive pronouns, they do not imply ownership, but identification and affection. He identifies her as his love. You are my love. And compliments her by calling her my beautiful one. This shows affection for her. These are terms of endearment. They are legitimate. They are popular. And they are stated in varied ways by the young men as they court the young ladies. But if they're right for each other, these are honest assessments, but they do not show possession. Only appreciation. Now the shepherd then makes reference to the arrival of spring. It is the time of new life mentioned in verses 11 and 12. The flowers appear and the latter rains are gone. And this weather forecast indicates that the time of year this conversation occurs is mid to late April. Now, I want to do some work here identifying the time of year. For once we nail the time of year, then we can understand some of the things that are going to take place and why they take place. So a little work now on time of year. We're doing weather forecast now. We go to Merrill Unger's Bible Dictionary, page 908, under the entry for rain. You remember rain, don't you? The ruling feature of the climate of Syria is the division of the year into a rainy and dry season. Toward the end of October, heavy rains begin to fall at intervals for a day or several days at a time. These are what the Bible calls the early or former rains. Now, I've got a chart here I hope you can see. I pulled this from some book I've got. And we'll focus up as much as it can be focused. And note, this is the average rainfall in Jerusalem by months. And you'll notice not raining in September. The rains, as we've just noted, begin in October, and they're sparse and scattered. And then they increase, and you have extremely heavy rain in December, January, and February, tapering in March, and then coming down to where they're sparse again in April, and then late April and May, it fades away. And then in the summer months, June, July, August, September, you don't hardly get any rain at all in that neck of the woods. No rain. Now, these former rains that have just been mentioned, the former rains are the ones that come in October. If you can imagine 4 months with virtually no rain in the Middle East, you can imagine how rough it is to try and plow a field. You couldn't do it. And so the field has to be softened up in order to plant. And these former rains begin to do that in October. And as the ground softens up, then they're able to plow it, and then they're able to sow their seed and get their crops in the ground. Then you have this tremendous amount of rain during what we would call the winter months. Now we could go into why you would plant a crop in October and November. We do that around here. You're not going to get much of a crop. This is a Mediterranean environment. The weather is dictated by the Persian Gulf in cooperation with the Mediterranean, in cooperation with the central mountains of Israel. And this makes growing crops in the wintertime possible. And you have tremendous rains during December, January, and February. And then as they taper off toward the end, these are the ones down here that actually feed the crops as they come to maturity and you have harvest in April and May. And then you get the things up out of the field because later it's all over for another 4 months as you go to the extremely hot and dry summer months. Now, toward the end of October, heavy rains begin to fall at intervals for a day or several days at a time. These are what the Bible calls the early or former rains. It opens the agricultural year. The soil, hardened and cracked by the long summer, is loosed, and the farmer begins plowing. Till the end of November, the average rainfall is not large, but it increases through December, January, and February, and it begins to abate in March and is practically over by the middle of April. The latter rains of Scripture are the heavy showers of March and April, coming as they do before the harvest and the long summer drought. They are of far more importance to the country than all the rains of the winter months. And that is why these are passed over in Scripture, and emphasis is laid alone on the early and latter rains. And this has given most people to believe that there are only two intervals of rain in the Syrian year, at the vernal and autumnal equinox. But the whole of the winter is the rainy season, and indeed we are told in the well-known lines of the Song of Songs, "Lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone." And that means that we're in late April here. These rains are beginning to fade away, and this begins in mid-April and goes to early May, and then they ultimately go away completely. These latter rains thus are very important because they give that final boost to the crops that are almost ready for harvest. Now, with the latter rains came the blossoming of flowers throughout the countryside, and in addition, a time for singing. The New American Standard translates the middle line of verse 12, quote, "The time has arrived for pruning the vines." Now, the word pruning is translated singing of birds in the King James. Singing has come in the New International Version. And pruning and singing has come, and that's in the New English Translation or the NET Bible. Now let's go back up to the vines, the New American Standard. The italicized words "the vines" are added to the New American Standard Translation. Anytime you see italics, it's saying this is not in the original, we've inserted this. And oftentimes this is very legitimate because of context. But the vines here is interesting because the New American Standard says pruning of the vines. It's an attempt by these translators to define what is being pruned. Now the words "of birds" are added to the King James to identify what is doing the singing. So which is it? Are vines being pruned or are birds singing? The etymology of the word in question here is important. It is the masculine noun zamir, Z-A-M-I-R, and its root definition does refer to the pruning of grapevines, but its derivatives later took on the idea of singing accompanied by the plucking of stringed instruments. So you can be picking grapes from the vines or pruning them, or you can be plucking a stringed instrument and singing. Now, the NET Bible's detailed translator's note number 6 presents the idea that both definitions are used by Solomon as a poetic parallelism, thus imputing both of these meanings to the same word. Thus, its translation, "the time for pruning and singing has come." Now, 17. In the context, this idea has merit. Here's a quote from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. "In the early spring, the plants must be pruned," that's the vines, "the plants must be pruned by cutting off dead and fruitless branches which are gathered and burned. As the grapes ripen, they must be watched to keep off jackals and foxes." For some reason, foxes and jackals love to come nibble on these vines as the buds were developing into grapes. Now, the Shulamite's family vineyard is in blossom. The vines are about to be the object of constant daily care and attention. Pruning is one of the most important of viticultural duties, and there are two major types that occur. Now, let me go to a book by Gary Derrickson and Earl Rodmacher. The book is The Disciple Maker, What Matters Most to Jesus. And this book really takes a good bit of time, 300 pages, to analyze our Lord's comment about the fruit and the vine that kicks off chapter 15 of the book of John. And therefore, as a result, you have to study winemaking and vines and pruning and everything you do to a grapevine. And so it's from this that I pull a few excerpts beginning on page 155. Now, these gentlemen write that basically two kinds of pruning occurred in the vineyard. Dormant pruning in the late fall, and then what accomplished, and then that is accomplished during the growing season. So there's pruning when they're dormant, in other words, the winter months, and then when they are in the growing season, they're pruned as well. Dormant pruning removed unwanted material from the branches, which were to be kept till the following season, including all remaining leaves. They had to go, as well as unwanted branches and water sprouts. So you have a vine, and it runs out. I'll make a vine. It looks like that. And then you have things coming off the side. And these can be sprouts or shoots. And some of them will, of course, obviously going to collect grapes on them, and some will not. Now, if the vine is going to keep these non-productive limbs alive, it's going to rob nutrients from the ones that's producing the grapes. So these guys that are into viticulture, caring of vineyards, they have the expertise to know when they go in there what to cut and what to leave alone. And if you cut too much, then you're going to get too much juice going into the grapes, and that's going to spoil the end as far as the wine that produces is concerned. So there needs to be a balance throughout the vine, not too much, not too little. And you've got to know what you're doing when you go in there to trim up these vines. Now, just sort of parenthesis, in John 15, we're not talking about people that are being clipped off here because they're not saved. They're being clipped off because they're not producing. But that's another story. So you have these two types of pruning that go on. Spring pruning removed succulent sprigs from the fruiting branches. See, these sprigs just sort of pop up and begin to rob nutrients, so you want to get rid of those. You want to keep these out here that are producing in the right balance. And you don't need something else coming on here that's going to rob nutrients. So these professionals go in there and do this clipping and pruning. And they know which ones to clip and which to leave alone. They remove succulent sprigs from the fruiting branches, dead and diseased wood, adventitious buds on the trunk of the vine, but not all non-fruiting branches. Some non-fruiting branches were kept on the vine. They are going to produce the following year. Serious pruning is not done during the spring growth, flowering, and fruit production. Sprigs that sprout from buds along the fruiting branch are cleared from the branches or the trunk of the vine, in the spring. I've noted that in a river birch I've got. This river birch wants to constantly put out new limbs from around the base of the trunk. And I don't want that to happen because it's going to rob from the height of the tree. It's got to now start trying to build an entirely new branch coming up almost out of the ground. Now, what sense does that make? It doesn't make any sense. So I go out there and I cut those off. Now, I'm not an expert on that, but I can figure that much out. So these people that run these vineyards know this, and they go in and do this type of pruning. Now, blooming occurred in late spring to early summer, from mid-July to mid-August, when most people were involved with threshing and winnowing the grain harvest. The elderly and children cared for the vineyards. Now, that's an important statement. The elderly and the children cared for the vineyards. When did they do that? Mid-July to mid-August. The spring removal of shoots reflects the process of ensuring that the plant is not allowed to grow too slowly by spreading its energy among the large number of suckers and water sprouts which appear on the main trunk as well as the fruiting branches. Principle emerges from this: maximum production is not the result of maximum sprigs and shoots. In other words, you can work yourself to death. You need to orient on what your spiritual gift is. You need to use your time properly to do the best you can with the assignment God has given you. Running around with your hair on fire does not result in good production. Point 19. Now, how this applies to our verse has to do with its historical setting. We have established that the time is spring, probably mid to late April, and this event, this tryst, occurred before the Shulamite was sent by her brothers up to the vineyards to drive off the foxes. And it's during the early summer that the grapes begin to ripen and are threatened by such predators as jackals and foxes. The shepherd describes the time of year as being perfect for elopement. The flowers are in bloom. The time has arrived for the pruning of the vines and for singing. He apparently had a good voice. He probably sang to her. Don't try that if you don't have a good voice. She will have to lie to you and tell you how beautiful. Remember that the word zamir can be translated pruning or singing. The shepherd is apparently adept on a stringed instrument and wishes to serenade his chosen one with a romantic ballad. He also mentions how the birds, or turtle doves, have begun their spring serenades. Now, he then notes the fig trees. The New American Standard claims they have ripened, but the adjective defining the figs is pag, P-A-G, and means a green fig. Another piece of information that helps us determine the time of year that the events remembered by the Shulamite take place. Well, the word for fig tree is te-enah, and this is the ficus carica, and we will do the definition at 10 till the hour and learn what we can by the fact that these fig trees are in bloom. You now have tea and crumpets to my left, and you're dismissed.